At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The first thing that happened in the financial industry bailout 2 years ago wasn't Lehman Brothers or AIG or the car companies. It was the government bailing out and then taking over Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And as the foreclosure mess gets messier, the Fannie-Freddie price tag is going up. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, offering business owners financial guidance for the long term. Information at massmutual.com. And by Reputation Defender, monitoring, protecting, and helping improve your online reputation while deleting personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Thursday today, the 21st of October. Great to have you here, as always. As with almost everything that happened back in the fall of 2008, the government takeover of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac happened over a weekend. We all woke up one Monday that September to learn we'd bailed out the two government housing companies to the tune of $200 billion. The federal office in charge of keeping an eye on Fannie and Freddie said today the total outlay so far isn't quite so bad, only $148 billion, but it could get worse. The Federal Housing Finance Agency says the total cost to taxpayers, depending on the state of the economy and the real estate market, could run as high as $259 billion when all is said and done. People are, of course, still trying to sort out exactly how badly the current foreclosure paperwork crisis could hit the housing industry. And there are some ideas being thrown around for how to get things back on track, including one that's as simple, it seems, as signing on the dotted line. It comes from Peter Swire. He teaches law at Ohio State. And he was also, until this past August, a housing economist for President Obama. Peter Swire, good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
All right. So what's your idea? Some banker signs his name and everything's fine?
Well, personal responsibility hasn't happened as much as a lot of us would like during the whole banking and mortgage crisis. So one central idea is under what's called Sarbanes-Oxley, the law we passed after Enron, under other laws, individuals in a company have to sign their name and say they've got the system under control. I think that might be a good idea to consider for the banks right now in this mortgage mess.
The idea being that if, say, Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, or Brian Moynihan at Bank of America, if they have to actually personally certify, they will then be more diligent in getting their underlings to do the right thing.
That's the idea that we've used in other laws, and I think it makes sense here.
But we've had Sarbanes-Oxley on the book now for 8 or 9 years. We still have financial crises and corporate problems. How do we know it's going to work?
Well, you know, we haven't really had the same Enron problems. We haven't seen that the accounting statements that are given out to investors have gone wrong.
How then does a signature solve a problem that is caused by false signatures, right? We had all these robo-signers, and now we have more signing. I mean, help me out.
Well, you know, there was a man named Mr. Steven who signed however many mortgages, right, thousands for GMAC. I think when a senior official puts the name on, it might be the head mortgage banker or it could be the general counsel, that's a serious statement at the top of the company. The question is, how do we get credible promises from the banks that they've really done the work? And putting them on the line is probably the way to do it.
How's this going to work in practice, though? Isn't Congress going to have to pass some national law since foreclosures are adjudicated on a state-by-state basis?
No, not at all. A bank could decide to do that itself. Also, the banks are talking to bank supervisors. They're talking to the state attorneys general and federal investigators. We often have consent decrees when there's been some area of problem. The consent decree should say, we're going to sign this and take personal responsibility.
Where do we go from here, then? How does this happen?
For this one, I think these investigations are going to go forward, the federal investigation, the state investigations. We're going to find out where there's problems, where there's not problems. I hope where there's not problems, we can start to signal to people, look, we've actually looked under this rock and it's okay. There's going to be some other things where there are going to be problems. Some of it's going to be house by house. Is this house subject to a good mortgage or not? There's no replacement for that when you're talking about one family's real property.
Say that again. We're going to have to go house by house, loan by loan to figure this out?
Some of it will have to be house by house, loan by loan. Who owns 12 Cherry Lane? We have to figure that out property by property. But a lot of the things, such as basically are the systems in place, that's where we want to get third-party audits or certifications or a series of representations and warranties or guarantees by the people who are running the system that they're really back in place.
Give me an estimate of how long it might take to get this, you know, pig through the python.
Well, there's two different things. One is, how are we going to clean up the documentation mess? That's going to be litigated over the next couple of years. Another problem is we have a backlog of between 1 and 3 years of houses that we need to sell into the market until we get that pig through the python. And that shadow inventory is why we need to be able to keep foreclosures going when they're valid so that we can clean through the inventory and get to the point where buyers and sellers are back into balance.
Peter Swire, he teaches law at The Ohio State University. He was, until August, a member of the Domestic Economic Policy staff at the White House. Professor, thanks a lot for your time.
Great to be here.
About the only business other than mortgage processing that you would probably rather not be in today is making cars. Toyota said it's recalling 1.5 million cars. You add that to the almost 8 million that Toyota's already recalled for that whole unintended acceleration thing, and it's just a headache. This time, it's problems with fuel pumps and brakes. Turns out, Honda has the same brake problem. It's planning to recall an undetermined number of cars. And the government said today that Ford has engine fire problems. If you feel like you've heard this whole story before, well, you kind of have. It's been a year of recalls, which kind of got us wondering whether drivers even pay attention to them anymore. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
When Toyota first started recalling cars for unintended acceleration last year, drivers really paid attention.
Well, concerned was still would be too light a word, and we had terrified customers.
Earl Stewart owns a Toyota dealership in North Palm Beach, Florida. He says it's a little different this time.
Thus far today, not a single call, and I'm standing around my showroom floor here at my Toyota dealership, and nobody's come up to me and voiced any concern whatsoever.
Part of it may be that nobody's died as a result of the problems with the brake fluid and fuel pumps, and they haven't even caused any accidents. Dave Sargent is in charge of global vehicle research at J.D. Power. He says drivers tend to head straight to their dealers when they think a problem is serious enough to cause a crash.
For other issues where the consumer doesn't perceive maybe an immediate safety concern, there may be a little bit of recall fatigue.
Not including today's announcement, Toyota says it's repaired about half the cars and trucks it's recalled in the last year. Some Toyota drivers just haven't bothered to get their cars fixed. But some buyers are clearly thinking twice before they buy a Toyota. In September, its U.S. market share was 15%, which is a few points lower than last year. But the company still has plenty of loyal drivers. Jeff Myers' Toyota Avalon was recalled earlier this year for floor mat problems, and now it's being recalled again.
When I get the notice, I'll take it in, but other than that, I'm not worried about it.
He drives 1,000 miles a week, and he says if he had to buy another car today, he'd get another Toyota. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, choppy, uneven, generally undecided. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. April in Paris might be great, as the song says, but I'd bet October 2010 is completely miserable. Millions of people have joined street protests over the government's plan to raise the retirement age. Airports are blocked. A quarter of all French gas stations are literally out of gas. Union leaders say they want to make it worse. They're calling for two more days of protests. But commentator Susan Lee says retirement benefits aren't a problem just for the French, you know.
For the past several months, commentators have enjoyed playing the U.S. is like game. For example, the U.S. is like Japan, where misguided monetary policy resulted in a decade of deflation and slower growth. Or the U.S. is like Greece, where big debts have shaken investor confidence. But people are missing the obvious and scary comparison. The U.S. is also a lot like France. Consider France's public sector employees. often described as living in a worker's paradise. Civil servants in France work less, yet their pay and retirement benefits are richer than in the private sector. But there's big trouble in this paradise. France can't afford its generous retirement benefits. Simply put, its pension system is in danger of collapse. The same goes for the U.S. Here, public sector employees also live in a paradise. They earn, on average, more per hour than their counterparts in the private sector. And their pension benefits are also fabulous. Just look at California. Some employees can retire at age 55, and it's a rich retirement with a monthly inflation-adjusted check for $3,000. That amounts to $1 million for each retiree. And it's pretty bad in the other states, too. Most of the public sector pension plans are in deep trouble. The Pew Foundation estimates that there's a $1 trillion gap between what the states have promised their workers and what they have in the bank to satisfy those promises. No question, we need to reduce benefits to avoid gigantic taxpayer bailouts. French workers have taken to the streets when faced with cuts in retirement benefits. They're staging a series of strikes, and it's easy to roll our eyes at the French strikers, but our own day of reckoning is at hand.
Economist Susan Lee lives in New York City. You can send us your comments no matter where you are. Marketplace.org is the website. Click on that link that says contact. Macy's is a retail institution. It's a retail institution with a 152-year history. But like just about every other big retailer these days, it's got to worry about becoming history. So the chain is taking a cue from the newer and hipper guys on the block, stores like H&M and Forever 21. Macy's said today it's going to start collaborating with hot new designers to sell their creations, but just for a limited time. Limited as in customers better get there fast. Marketplace's Janet Babin explains it's all about the buzz.
Meet the first designer Macy's hopes will ignite that shopping buzz.
My name is Kinder Agugini.
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 The Italian-born Agugini describes his style as
an imaginary marriage between Coco Chanel and Sid Vicious. Chic, elegant, mixed with a rough edge and rock and roll.
Not exactly Miracle on 34th Street stuff. But the competition left Macy's with little choice. Stores like Target have had huge success with the high-low strategy, high fashion designs at low prices. So retail strategist Wendy Liebman says Macy's had to go big.
They need to do something that's a bit more esoteric, otherwise it'll just look like what Target's doing or H&M's doing.
Macy's won't say which designers are up next, but a new one will hit stores every 2 months starting in February. The lines will be limited, available in about 250 Macy's stores. Better to make the designs exclusive. Buy it now at Macy's for $50, or tomorrow it'll be on eBay for $500. That urgency appeals to fashion-forward young women, just about the only group that's buying right now. Frank Badillo is an economist with Kantar Retail.
Some of the strongest gains of late have been among younger shoppers, and department store retailers are trying to inject the designer names to create excitement.
And at a cost of $50 to $300,
Agugini
designs could be very exciting for Macy's. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
And now, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials added 38 points this Thursday, a third of 1% closed at 11,146. The NASDAQ up 2 points, nearly a tenth percent, 2,459. At the bell, the S&P 500 also tacked on 2 points, about a tenth percent, finished at 1,180. On the earnings front, Southwest Airlines said an increase in passengers pushed third quarter profits to more than $200 million. Shares vaulted nearly 3.5% higher. Brisk sales of smoothies and dollar items boosted McDonald's profits by 10%. Shares of the world's biggest burger chain sizzled up 1.3% today. Heavy equipment maker Caterpillar beat Wall Street expectations, earning nearly $800 million in profits, but that did not help the stock at all. Fears of slower growth bulldozed shares 1.25%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.54%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. And by Novo Nordisk, since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices at novonordisk-us.com. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll also find our new podcasts, The Midday Update, Freakonomics, and The Tech Report, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on mass layoffs for September. That's when 50 or more workers from a single employer lose their job. In Los Angeles, President Obama speaks at a political rally at the University of Southern California. The event is open to the public. And psychologist and counterculture icon Timothy Leary was born on October 22, 1920. He would be 90 if he were still with us. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This being Thursday, we got a report called First-Time Claims for Unemployment this morning. They were down just a tad, but the trend number, that is people making continuing claims, stayed right where it was. That's the case in a lot of cities across the country, including in Portland, Oregon. So today on our series, The Art of Money, singer-songwriter Corin Tucker. You might know her originally from a band called Slater Kinney. She's fronting the Corin Tucker Band now with a new album out about how the economy is affecting her hometown. Corin, it's great to talk to you.
Thank you for having me.
So you've been gone for a couple of years now. It's been like 2006 since Slater Kinney was around. Where you been?
I've been at home with my two lovely children.
Nice.
Yeah, being a mom mostly.
How does that go making music, though?
You know, it's been fun. It's been good. I mean, it's a juggling act, but I think it is for most working parents.
How did you and why did you come back to playing music again?
Well, I got asked to do a benefit, actually, for the small publication store in Portland, Oregon called Reading Frenzy that was having trouble with a tough economy. And I couldn't say no to playing the show and doing a couple of songs. And so once I played the show, a lot of people said, wow, you should really, you know, you should really record these songs. Mm. And Kill Rock Stars said, we'd love to work with you, you know, if you make an album. It just was kind of like getting pulled back in,
yeah.
You know.
But it sounds like it was a good thing. I mean, they weren't dragging you, right?
Great thing. Yeah. No, I mean, you know, once I performed for an audience again, it was like, oh, I love doing this.
Did you have that musical creativity bouncing around in your head even while you were dealing with the kids in the middle of the night and all?
Oh, yeah. I don't think it ever really goes away, that thirst, I guess, for creativity.
The bookstore that you mentioned that's having a tough time in the economy, that is kind of a theme of this album. There are a couple of songs that really point out how difficult it is for people out there. I want to play one of them. It's called Thrift Store Coats, and we're going to play a little bit, and then I want to ask you something. Tell me the story of this song. I mean, it's a pretty good little story.
Yeah, I think it was really around the beginning of 2008, end of 2007, that the community of parents that I sort of pal around with in Portland, where my son goes to elementary school, you know, we all hang out on the playground with our kids,
yeah.
Just, you know, like everybody else. And things started going really badly. And, you know, a couple of the people lost their jobs. And then another dad lost his job. And these are families with two kids, one with four kids.
Mm.
And it seemed like it started to snowball. And it suddenly was like, when is this going to end? When is it going to start getting better? Because it just wasn't.
And you went into this fundraiser, right? Into the coat closet?
Yeah, the yearly auction for my son's elementary school. I walked down to put my coat in the coat closet, and I looked in, and I was like, wait, really? Like, and every single coat was sort of a shabby thrift store coat. And it was like, oh, yeah, people are just kind of getting by with what they already have.
There's a line in that song. It says, we were spoiled our whole lives through. It sort of sounds like you feel your generation wasn't really prepared for this economy and what's happening.
Not prepared at all. I feel like we were the generation that grew up in the 80s. I mean, that was just, you know, of course, you know, you're a middle class kid, you're going to go to college. Like, there was grant money, there was funding, there were jobs. You had the choice of which job you were going to have. To suddenly be this generation and to have had children and be sort of set up, you know, with your chosen profession, and then to have those jobs just go away, I think it's been a shock.
You are not by any means a single mom. You're married, you have a husband, and all of that jazz. But he travels for work. He's a documentary filmmaker.
Yes.
Which led you to write another song, which is my favorite song on this album, as a matter of fact, called Half a World Away. It's really hard to do things today when one parent's working, one's with the kids. I mean, you have to make these choices that we're all making now, you know, and you do it with a huge sense of sacrifice.
Yeah, I mean, that it's definitely part of both being artists and loving what we do. And my husband's extraordinarily talented. And the documentary he made in Africa is extremely important. It's about antiretroviral treatment for AIDS patients.
Yeah, we should give his name here. It's Lance Bangs.
Lance Bangs.
He makes a lot of films. Yeah.
Lance Bangs. And the film that he made is called The Lazarus Effect.
And not to turn it on its head, but he's away 75% of the time. That means you've got the kids 75% of the time.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? So I'm mom a lot of the time by myself. And that's sometimes difficult, too.
So look back at the 22-year-old Corin Tucker and Heavens to Betsy, your first band, and Slater Kinney. How has the business of making music changed? I mean, when you first got going, there was none of this file sharing. There was no iTunes. I mean, none of that.
Yeah.
How do you make a buck?
That's a really good question. I mean, for the most part, I really don't think that artists have figured it out. I think that the problems, the economic problems that people are facing, you know, they happen in the music industry first. Unfortunately, it's a lot of the smaller artists that were hit and, you know, sometimes put out of business by not being able to sell their records and CDs anymore.
You must be at the point now where younger artists come to you and say, how do I do what you did? How do I not just make it big, but have this identity and develop my voice and my instrument? What do you say to them?
My main advice is to take risks. You know, especially I think for young women, to not be afraid to fail, not to be afraid to write a song that sucks, you know, that people don't like, because I think that's such a hard thing for young women, especially is feeling afraid of that criticism, of feeling afraid of failure. You have to just let go.
The new album from Corin Tucker and her band is called 1,000 Years. We've got thrift store coats on our website just as a teaser for you. It's marketplace.org. Corin, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
The political news out of France is strikes and strikes and more strikes, as we talked about earlier. The government really wants to get them over with. Today, it pushed up a vote on the retirement age to this week from next. The hope is that the thing being a done deal might convince protesters somehow to go home. But there is another story over there that's causing quite a stir. The number two hamburger chain in France, it's called Quick, Le Quick, I imagine, says some of its outlets have gone halal. That is, they're only putting things on the menu that practicing Muslims are allowed to eat. The company says it's going to increase sales in parts of the country that have big Muslim populations. But in parts of the country that don't have big Muslim populations, not popular at all. John Lawrenson reports now from Paris.
Customers line up for lunch at a Quick restaurant near Paris. Now, at 22 of the chain's 362 French outlets, the beef and chicken they buy is certified halal, with meat from animals slaughtered according to Islamic ritual. Customer Salim Batri says it's great.
Before, when I came here with friends, I had to wait for them before I could eat, or I'd eat something else, the fish, for example. Now, even if I don't choose the meat, I feel better than before. It's nice to know people are thinking of us. I'm touched by the gesture. Enormously touched.
Non-Muslims, though, like François Moreau and Didier Schmidt, are divided.
So it doesn't change anything for me. It's the same taste.
I don't think it's a good idea. I don't like the fact that you try to make something for one community or another. France is a republic, you know, and I think things might be the same for everybody.
But, Quick says, the commercial argument is compelling. At some of its outlets, it matters to customers that the precepts of Islam are followed. Véronique Mejati-Alami is manager of the Quick restaurant in the Parisian suburb of Garges-lès-Gonesse. She explains how the company decides when it's time to switch, for instance, when hamburger sales are below par.
When there's a high proportion of sales of fish-based products above the national average and sales of bacon-based products below the national average.
Another indicator is when sales at a particular branch drop significantly during the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. In Quick outlets that meet these criteria and where they've experimented with going halal, the company says sales have almost doubled. But following the market in this way worries some French leaders. In Britain, people got upset when McDonald's tried a similar experiment. Some animal rights advocates objected because animals used for halal meat aren't stunned before they're killed. This isn't such a concern for the French. As parliamentarian Jacques Millard, a member of President Sarkozy's UMP party, points out, either way, it ends up on your plate. He objects for another reason.
I think it's very dangerous to use, in a commercial objective, religious approach. I think you are entering a process which leads to the building up of ghettos. What do we want for society in France? Do we want communities living apart from each other, or are we French citizens?
Quick has promised to make non-halal options available in its halal restaurants. But these meals will be second best, say critics, not prepared on the premises. Meanwhile, other restaurant chains have gone all halal on the quiet. A self-service restaurant chain called Flunch, for example, and on a larger scale, Kentucky Fried Chicken, where all the chain's 100 outlets are now halal.
Bon appétit, madame.
In Paris, I'm John Lawrenson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to helping financial advisors and their clients pursue a more comfortable retirement. You can get the latest at RothIRAblog.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, Bloomberg News reported this morning that Google has saved more than $3 billion over 3 years thanks to the help of a tax haven in Bermuda. Microsoft and Facebook do it. The IRS did sign off on the deal. It's called transfer pricing, and it is legal. Not sure how it meshes with that whole don't be evil thing, though. And that is Marketplace on this Thursday from American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 38 points, about a third of 1%. The Nasdaq picked up 2 points, barely a fraction of a percent. The S&P 500 also tacked on 2 points, about 0.2%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on the big broadcast, caramel macchiatos, soy lattes, and a nice Merlot.
If people want late hours and wine, I don't know if they're going to be going to the same place they get their coffee.
Starbucks tries serving different beverages. I'm Kai Ruzdahl. Pour yourself a glass. Join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.